Welcome to The B Word, a podcast about humans, organisations, behaviour. I'm your host, James Healy. As the old corporate adage has it, culture eats strategy for breakfast. Organisations obsess over culture. Executives are constantly asking themselves and their teams, how do we create a performance culture, a safety culture, an innovation culture? How will we maintain our organisational culture when we're all working from home? But what actually is culture? And how do we go about changing it? If only there were a whole academic discipline dedicated to answering just these questions. When most people think about anthropology, if they think about it at all, they imagine strange tribes in the jungles of Papua New Guinea or Maasai warriors on the plains of East Africa. People who don't sound like us, look like us, or act like us. But what if anthropology were applied to people who are like us, to our own societies and organizations? Today's guest is an anthropologist with a PhD in Tajik wedding rituals. She's also an award-winning financial journalist who famously predicted the 2008 global financial crisis. How was an expert in obscure Central Asian marriage customs able to see what countless economists and bankers couldn't? And what can we as individuals and organizations learn from this? Gillian Tett serves as the chair of the editorial board and editor-at-large US of the Financial Times. She writes weekly columns covering a range of economic, financial, political, and social issues. She's also the co-founder of FT Moral Money, a twice-weekly newsletter that tracks the ESG revolution in business and finance. Previously, Gillian was the FT's US managing editor and held a number of editorial roles in London, Tokyo, and Brussels. She's the author of four best-selling books, Saving the Sun, A Wall Street Gamble to Rescue Japan from its Trillion-Dollar Meltdown, Fool's Gold, How Unrestrained Greed Corrupted a Dream, Shattered Global Markets, and Unleashed a Catastrophe, The Silo Effect, and most recently, Anthrovision, A New Way to See Life and Business. Before joining the Financial Times in 1993, she was awarded a PhD in social anthropology from Cambridge University, based on fieldwork in the former Soviet Union. Gillian, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Delighted to be on your show.
So, Gillian, I've spent much of my life explaining to people why a philosophy degree isn't a complete waste of time. As you recount at the start of Anthrovision, you've done the same with anthropology. So forgive me, why is anthropology useful?
Well, if you think philosophy is a hard sell for business and financial folk, I mean, try cultural anthropology, try a PhD in Tajik wedding rituals. I spent much of my career as a financial journalist having to explain to CEOs and investors and central bankers why on earth anything I've studied actually matters for the modern world. But the reality is that we are all human beings who are tribal, who are shaped by cultural assumptions we inherit from our surroundings, who are essentially influenced by all of our unconscious assumptions about how we organize our space, people, lives, time, etc., etc. And just as it can be very beneficial to go and look at other cultures with an anthropology background, it's equally beneficial to look at the modern tribes of Wall Street, Washington, the City of London, Tokyo, or anywhere else in the world.
So when most people think of anthropology, I think it's fair to say they imagine exotic tribes in far-off locations, usually arcane rituals conducted in strange languages. With that in mind, can you talk to us about your experiences at a rather infamous credit derivatives conference in the south of France?
Well, a lot of people think that anthropology is basically Indiana Jones for academics. You go off to weird, wacky places, study exotic rituals, and you don't do anything which has relevance to the modern world. The reality is, though, that actually it can be incredibly powerful in terms of seeing what's hidden in plain sight and what's really happening. And I first realized that back in 2005 when I went to a credit derivatives conference in the south of France. That was, I should point out, 2 years before the great financial crisis. And I went to the conference very much curious about this newfangled world of financial innovation. And what struck me really powerfully was that there were so many parallels between the way that investment banking conferences happen and the type of thing I'd once studied as an anthropologist, which was Tajik wedding rituals. Banking conferences bring together a scattered tribe. It enables people to recreate social ties through rituals. It also enables them to recreate a distinctive set of cultural assumptions and a shared worldview that they often don't reflect on very explicitly. And when I sat in that conference hall in 2005 and looked at the type of shared worldview that was being created through the conference, through rituals like PowerPoints and bar discussions and things like that, I could see that essentially the underbelly of finance was spinning out of control in a way that, frankly, most regulators or politicians didn't see at all.
I think that's really interesting. And I think that you talk sometimes about social silences and essentially what is unsaid. And I think that's very relevant in the financial sector. It's very relevant in that world of exotic derivatives, which is really quite small and known only to a few. And as you say, wasn't widely understood outside of that. Outside of that small core group. What are social silences and why do they matter?
Well, we live in a world drowning with noise, and it's incredibly easy to focus on what everyone's talking about or what's most visible or what you think, because of your pre-existing biases, is the most important thing. But the reality is that all around us are huge areas of social silence. Parts of the world that we ignore because it either falls between the cracks of the kind of classification boxes we use to organize the world, or we just ignore because it seems boring and dull and geeky and covered in acronyms. And before 2007, the world of credit derivatives was a classic area of social silence because most of the media coverage and political debate before 2008 was all about equity markets or hedge funds or leveraged finance. And there was almost no discussion in public about what was happening in the credit derivatives world, even though it was growing very fast and a crucial part of the financial sector's revenues. Fast forward a few years, and the whole question about epidemic risk was another big area of social silence. Epidemiologists have known for years that there was a danger of something like COVID happening around the world. And yet people were ignoring it because it seemed geeky, dull, technical, shrouded in acronyms. Exactly the same thing could be said about some of the dangers stalking the tech sector in the early years of the last decade in relation to ad tech and all the issues there about whether tech companies could or should be protecting consumer privacy better or stopping malicious actors from using social media to launch dangerous campaigns. After 2016, that suddenly burst into public view. But it was hidden in plain sight for many, many years before that. So one of the things as an anthropologist that I'm passionately interested in, both on a macro level and micro level, is trying to look at social silences and the parts of the world that we ignore because we're culturally trained to simply look away.
So how would you use anthropological techniques to penetrate those social silences? What would you look for to try and understand what's really happening?
Well, the essence of anthropology is really a three-part intellectual journey that, frankly, anybody could and should take. The first step is to actively embrace a bit of culture shock from time to time in your life. In other words, to go and immerse yourself in the lives and minds of people who are different from you. They can be radically different from you, living on the other side of the world. I went off as an anthropologist and did a PhD living in Soviet Tajikistan, which for me in England was the other side of the world and very alien and different. But you can also get exposed to difference simply by walking to the end of your street and talking to people who have very different lives from you, or going online and finding people who are simply not part of your social tribe. And there's two really important reasons for doing that. One is that it actually enables you to get empathy for another point of view and realize the variety of perceptions and experiences that are out there in the world today. And that is so important in a world where we are so connected to each other through global systems and constantly exposed to contagion risk in the sense of what other people do can affect us. So the first thing is to get empathy for others. The second point, though, is a sheer act of immersing yourself in the lives and minds of someone who's different not only teaches you about how other strangers live, it also enables you to look at yourself more clearly. Because the Chinese have this wonderful phrase that a fish can't see water. None of us can see the cultural assumptions that shape our lives precisely because they're so familiar. But if you jump out of your fishbowl and then look back, you get a much clearer sense of what's really driving your world, which leads me to social silences. When you get that insider-outsider perspective, jump out of your fishbowl and look back, you can start to see the parts of the world that you normally ignore precisely because it's so familiar. And just to go back to the issue of credit derivatives with the financial sector before the great financial crisis, after the great financial crisis, lots of journalists and politicians thought that bankers had somehow been hiding what was happening in the credit derivatives world due to some kind of James Bond-style plot. The reality is, actually, most of what was happening was hidden in plain sight. And it was hidden in plain sight because people outside finance were ignoring it because it seemed so boring and geeky and dull and covered in acronyms. And culturally, we're trained to shy away from things that seem geeky and dull. I mean, I often joke the best way to hide something in plain sight is to give it an acronym. But inside the financial world, the people involved in the whole world of credit derivatives were so immersed in it, so used to it, that they couldn't see how peculiar the pattern was either, and they couldn't see the risks that were developing hidden in plain sight.
It's an interesting perspective that you can only really understand your own culture and yourself when you get a bit of distance. And one of the things I'm fortunate enough to do is work with different organizations and essentially take that insider-outsider perspective within organizations. Now, one of the things that becomes apparent when you do that is that context is key. And if you want to understand behavior, you absolutely have to understand the context that it's happening. You've got some really fascinating examples of this, including one which I think is probably the first original thing I've read on Donald Trump in about 5 years. Do you want to talk about those examples? Because I think that really brings to life this idea that you can only understand something when you fully understand the context in which it happens and the context from which it comes.
Well, essentially what I'm trying to argue is that we live in a world where it's human nature to have tunnel vision. We're all surrounded by so much stuff and information and people and things that we have to train ourselves to focus, otherwise we can't get anything done. And the way that 20th, first century professions and careers operate, it actually exacerbates that tunnel vision because we're all so darn busy and we often have such technically complicated jobs that we have to focus, focus, focus. That's what you're told in any business school. But the problem with focusing extensively with tunnel vision is that you can end up ignoring the context. And the context matters enormously, particularly if the context is changing or the context is shaping what's happening in the bit that we're focusing on. So to take a really trivial example, people have been talking about teenagers and how and why they use cell phones and why they're so addicted forever. And people discuss it just in terms of the cell phone or just in terms of teenagers and their technology habits. But there's a really great anthropologist called Dana Boyd who went out and actually observed teenagers for a long time in terms of what they were doing with their cell phones, who pointed out that actually you can't hope to understand what teenagers are doing unless you look not just at cell phones, but their real world physical existence too. In the sense that if you track back what's happened to, say, an American suburban teenager in the last 100 years, 100 years ago, teenagers had a lot of freedom to roam physically in the real world, to go out and explore, to congregate with their friends and to test boundaries. Today, teenagers are physically very constrained. They're driven everywhere by their parents. They're not allowed on the streets because of stranger danger, etc., etc. So cyberspace has become one of the few places they can actually go out and explore and test boundaries and congregate without parental controls. And if you look at the use of teenage cell phone patterns in that respect, looking not just at the cell phones, but also the physical environment, the context, you get a much better sense of what's actually really going on with teenagers. Or to take a completely different example with, say, Donald Trump, if you look at how and why Donald Trump appealed to so many voters in America, you have to recognize that so much of what he was using to communicate was not the stuff that journalists focused on, which was his words, his specific language, his speeches. And those speeches often seem very peculiar to journalists because they didn't make sense. He was communicating as much through performative rituals and tapping into a set of cultural patterns, which were really quite deeply embedded, but very poorly understood. In particular, he was often borrowing the language and performance aspect of wrestling to communicate with people, in the sense that if you go to a wrestling match in America, what you have are these vast emotional staged performances of aggression, of name calling. If you want to know where all these phrases like Crooked Hillary came from, it was taken straight from the wrestling ring. You have a lot of whipped up, manufactured conflict. And you also crucially have an audience who know that on one level, what they're seeing is not real in the sense that it's stage managed. And it matters because it's part of an experience, but it doesn't necessarily represent the literal rational truth that most Western educated elites are always looking for. So many people were essentially experiencing the, you know, Donald Trump speeches through performance rituals, through the language of wrestling or the experience of wrestling, not through the kind of rational text-based analysis that educated elites were used to looking at politics through. And that's one reason why so many Western educated elites, including the media, failed to take Donald Trump seriously, although they were taking him literally, or rather because they were taking him literally. So context is everything, not just for teenagers or politics, but also for business.
I think there's a lot to unpick there. And I think the teenager example is great because most parents, probably all parents, at least in Western countries, would see phone use as one of those behaviors that you want to change or you want to influence. But most of the time, the approach to trying to change that behavior is focused on the behavior itself. It's not focused on the context. And within behavioral science, there's a lot of focus on sort of perceived irrational behaviors and this idea that humans are not as logical as we like to think. But so often, what that actually boils down to is humans are not trying to solve the problem that we think they're trying to solve. They're not trying to answer the question that we think they're trying to answer. And as you say with Donald Trump, anyone thinking about him rationally and logically and assessing policy and personality would come to the conclusion that those people did. His supporters were not looking at him in that way at all. They were looking at him from a different context. And I think it's a really powerful and really resonant example of what happens when you fail to understand that context.
Well, I couldn't agree more, because I think that one of the key messages that an Australian anthropologist called Genevieve Bell tried to impart in the tech world, she worked at Intel in Silicon Valley for many years. One of the key messages she tried to impart was that just because it's your worldview, you can't assume it's everyone else's worldview. And on one level, we all think we know that. We all recognize, yes, other people think differently from me. But it's human nature to assume that my worldview is natural, normal, inevitable, unchanging, and that somehow everyone else should have my worldview, and if they don't, they're wrong. And when we're very busy, when we work in specialized professions, when we tend to hang out just with our social tribe, that sense of presuming that it's my worldview and that's natural and normal becomes more entrenched. And that can cause so many terrible mistakes to happen, whether it's journalists misreading Donald Trump in 2016, or whether it's people at Intel failing to see how consumers around the world were actually thinking, because most of the engineers in Intel were young men living in Silicon Valley, or whether it's in almost any field of business, you get, you know, executives and leaders thinking that other people should think like we do and failing to see what really matters.
I think the example that springs to mind here, and I hear this so often when talking with organizations, they talk about a siloed culture. They talk about a siloed mindset. And we've got different departments within the organization, but they think in a very siloed way. And I know you've previously done work in this area. Keen to hear any examples or any insights that you have specifically around that silo within an organization.
Well, silos are a huge problem in today's world. And in some ways, silos are an entirely natural phenomenon. They're part of being human. We all live in a world where we're drowning in so much information and processes and stuff and people that we have to organize people and things and ideas into boxes simply to get stuff done. You know, you couldn't run a big company on an entirely open plan mindset because it would be chaotic. So you have to organize things. But the problem is that human beings tend to organize the world around them into systems that suited the world that existed 10 years ago. And the world can change around a company or an organization or a person much faster than we can reorganize our internal bureaucratic structures or our minds or our lives or our spaces. So to give you a couple of examples, Sony, the Japanese company, had a massive hit with the Sony Walkman back in the last decades of the 20th century, did incredibly well with it. And then at the end of the 20th century, it was clear that the world was moving from analog to digital and that music would be increasingly portable online. And Sony seemed like the obvious company to dominate that new world because inside Sony, it had both hardware, brilliant consumer electronics designers, it had software, it had a computing label, and it had a music label in the sense that it had a big music company in Hollywood. So most people assumed that Sony was going to dominate portable music, that you'd have basically a digital Sony Walkman. But in reality, Sony completely failed to do that because the three different areas of its business were in such deeply entrenched silos that they were competing with each other and cannibalizing each other, and they couldn't come together fast enough to actually break down the boundaries and to reflect what was happening outside Sony, which was a collapse between content, software, and hardware. It took a startup or it took a new company without the internal silos, namely Apple, to actually come up with the iPod, which actually blended software, content, and hardware in a really creative way and broke down the silos. Exactly the same pattern can be seen in the banking sector before 2008, where essentially the real problem in the great financial crisis or the leading up to the great financial crisis was that investment banks had such rigid silos, such rigid tribal distinctions inside the banks that the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. And lots of the risks associated with credit derivatives and mortgages went completely unnoticed for far too long. But that silo problem keeps cropping up over and over again in almost any company or business organization. And in many ways, it's one of the reasons why anthropology can help, because anthropologists are paid to try and take a holistic view of life, to look at how all the bits join up together, to look at where the unstated boundaries are between different silos, and also, above all else, to ask what's falling between the cracks of the boxes that we create. They don't just so much think out of the box, anthropologists. They try to ask, why do we have boxes at all? And what's being concealed because we have boxes.
So I think you talked there about a number of ways in which anthropology and anthropological techniques can be used to observe and understand what's happening in organizations and really unpick the culture of that organization. I'm interested in your thoughts on how you can use anthropological techniques, not just to observe, but actually to change culture within organizations.
Well, anthropologists historically have often been quite wary of being activists. They tend to be observers. They don't tend to come out with neat PowerPoints saying you should do X, Y, and Z. However, anthropologists can offer insights which are absolutely fundamental to trying to create better organizations. So one of the first things that anthropologists can do, in some ways the simplest, is to persuade company leaders or business people to actually go and listen to their consumers with an open mind. And instead of starting off with the assumption that producers know what consumers want or know what the problems are they're trying to solve, they actually go out there and try and start with a completely blank slate as if they were a Martian landing amongst consumers or whatever the customer is, and listen, and try and take out the ego and the preconceptions and really start to get a real sense of what really matters. So that's one first very simple way that anthropologists can help. A second way that anthropologists can help, though, is to look at the question of how a company is actually organized and run, and all the things that are being missed because everyone thinks they know how the world is working and aren't listening to each other or spotting their own shortcomings. To give you a very tangible example, there's an anthropologist called Elizabeth Bridey who worked inside General Motors for a number of years. And she started off working on the assembly lines, where she saw, when she employed anthropological techniques to observe the people working on the assembly lines, that the top management of General Motors had no idea what was actually happening at the grassroots of their assembly lines and why they were essentially so unproductive and why there was so much conflict between the unions and the management. She uncovered a fascinating pattern of what anthropologists call foot dragging, not overt rebellion, but covert forms of resistance amongst the workers, because the type of messages the managers were giving to the workers were completely contradictory and frankly impossible to fulfill. So she made some very practical suggestions about how the factory floor could be made to work much better and assembly lines could actually be overhauled to make them more productive. She later went on and looked at why an attempted merger between engineering teams from Germany, Tennessee and Detroit was going so badly wrong. And she realized that the problems in the attempted merger were not the ones that top managers thought, which was that there was some kind of ethnic clash between the Germans and the Americans, or some kind of argument about engineering techniques, but there was a really fundamental communication problem between the different groups of engineers in terms of how they define their work processes. And essentially all three groups were totally misunderstanding each other. That one of the key issues was that all three groups had a completely different set of cultural assumptions around what a meeting was supposed to do, whether it was actually was supposed to rubber stamp a decision or act as a kind of brainstorming moment. And because all three groups had different ideas about what a meeting was, and because they didn't recognize they had different ideas about what a meeting was, whenever they kept calling meetings to try and resolve the conflict, it made the problem worse because the three different groups came into the meetings with different ideas about how the meeting should proceed and then got furious with each other. So that type of observation about everyday life inside companies can be absolutely crucial. But there's one just last point I'd make about how companies can use anthropology, which is that another really powerful benefit of anthropology is that because it looks at context, it looks at the wider environment beyond a company, which includes issues like climate change, environmental issues, inequality, supply chain factors. You know, anthropology is dedicated to trying to put companies into context and institutions into context in which they operate. And that's a perspective which is really badly needed today as more and more companies grapple with issues around sustainability and environmental, social and governance goals.
There's some great things there. I think that spending time in different organizations, it's often struck me that the way they conduct meetings is really instructive, and you can learn a lot very quickly about an organization and about an organization's culture from meetings. So I really love that example. I'd like to close by asking one final question, and that would be, what would be your advice to organizations in terms of better understanding and, I guess, transforming their culture to meet the demands of the modern world? How should organizations use anthropology to ready themselves for this world that we're facing today?
I think the most important thing of all is to recognize that, as Genevieve Bell said at Intel, just because it's your worldview, you can't assume it's everyone else's. That applies in terms of any company or organization when it looks outside the organization to the customers it's trying to serve. You need to be incredibly sensitive to the idea that actually your customers may have a completely different perception of the world from what you assume. You need to have that concept when you look at the communities you operate in, because communities around you may see your company completely different from you. And so much of the issues around ESG today have erupted because communities in which companies are operating don't see the world in the same way. But you also need to hang on to that concept that just because it's your worldview, it may not be somebody else's, when it comes to looking inside companies as well. Because so often the top leaders are impervious to the difference of views inside their companies and have a very flawed vision of how their company is operating, because at the bottom, all kinds of practices may be going on that they simply don't know about. And it's important to stress that just because we're all going into the digital space today, that doesn't mean that somehow we stop being tribal or that culture doesn't matter because computers appear to be culture-free. Quite the contrary. If anything, the digital world makes us more tribal, not less, because we have a chance to define our identities and define our information sources. And what we do online in cyberspace is absolutely a cultural phenomena which needs to be understood as well. So the last point I'll make is that COVID-19, the lockdown, the pandemic, has shown us why our rituals and cultural patterns matter so deeply. We've learned that you can't beat a pandemic just with medical science. You have to change behavior, and that requires social science too. But it's also shown us that actually our cultural patterns can change sometimes. 18 months ago, who would have imagined that Westerners would have been wearing face masks routinely on the streets? And in many ways, that gives us an amazing opportunity to not just reflect on our cultural patterns, reflect on the assumptions that shape us and how they're different from others, but also change them. And in that lies a huge opportunity, particularly as and when companies return to the office after lockdown and think once again about how they're going to organize these strange tribes of people called workers.
I think that's a great place to finish. And I think it's a great observation that COVID has upended what we think of as culture. And I think it's provided a huge opportunity for organizations to really focus on culture and think intentionally about what their culture is and what they want their culture to be. And I think anthropology and ethnographic techniques have a huge role to play in how they do that.
Well, thank you very much indeed. And it's been great to be on your show. Thank you.
Thank you, Gillian. There's a number of interesting lessons here for organizations. To understand culture, we need to carefully observe the rituals, norms, and behaviors and see what's actually happening, not just what people say is happening. We need to take that insider-outsider perspective and listen to what's not being said, as well as what is, those social silences that Gillian talked about. We need to embrace difference to understand that other people in other parts of our organizations may not see the world as we do or think like we do, and therefore they may not behave in the way that we anticipate or want. And we need to remember that context is key. If we want to understand behavior in organizations, we need to really understand the context of those organizations. We need to truly understand the culture. You've been listening to The B Word, a podcast produced by Margot Zunis and Emma Stewart, and presented by me, James Healy.